Hello and welcome to Blockchain Gaming World episode 75. I'm your host, John Jordan, and joining me this week is Gabby Dizon. How's it going, Gabby?
Is it 75 already? I think this is my third time on your podcast, so doing good.
Yeah, you're one of the, I think there's a few people who've done three. You're the only one who's done a video one. We did that video podcast back in
Dubai
a year ago. But we've not seen each other for a while now because you're in the Philippines and I'm in the UK.
Yes.
We've just got the internet.
That's right.
How have you been keeping in these interesting times?
Well, been mostly at home trying to avoid going out. So that's given me actually a lot more time to kind of just do a lot of research and poke into different things. And yeah, I would say it's been a most interesting last 4 to 8 weeks. I've been very, very engaged, very interesting things going on.
You have, and it's been interesting because obviously we follow each other on Twitter, and I've kind of noticed the content on your Twitter has changed quite a lot over the kind of last few months. we've stopped talking about so much about games, and suddenly you've become a connoisseur of crypto art. So I guess this was one of the reasons we thought it might be nice to do a podcast now. So talk us through how that came about, because. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah, so of course, as you know, I've been in blockchain games for the last 2 years, and playing a lot in Axie Infinity, made some money there. And it actually started last year because of an artist called Josie Bellini. She was one of the first crypto artists to get pretty famous. And what had happened was that I bought a piece of land in Axie Infinity for 0.16 Ether. And I sold it for double that. So it was 0.32. And then I bought a Josie Bellini artwork for 0.3 Ether. And I really liked it. I kept it. And then after a year, I had sold it for 3 ETH. So it was 10x gain in 1 year. And I was like, wow, this, I have to investigate this a little bit further. So I started digging in a bit. A good friend of mine from the Bitcoin space, Luis, he was an artist in makersplace.com. So Makersplace is one of the platforms for rare digital art, which they call art that is tokenized on the blockchain. So I started checking it out, started buying a bit of his works, and I really enjoyed the process of just buying rare digital art. There's something about, you know, the scarcity, the rarity, connecting with the art and the artist, and not needing to have any utility at all. That is actually very interesting about art. As I started buying, I kind of like start to decode what the business is like, who the popular artists are, who the big whale buyers are, what the different platforms are, and what are the differences between them. So it's actually a very intricate ecosystem that has really exploded the use case of NFTs, which are quite different from games at all, because as I said, like for art, there doesn't need to be a use case. You just want to be able to buy it, stare at it, and probably display it and sell it in the future.
Yeah, I'm nothing like the connoisseur of you, but it's interesting. Having kind of looked around a little bit, and I know the guys at Known Origin, just kind of socially. So I've always been interested in kind of what they're doing there, and it is interesting how these platforms kind of seem to have quite different kind of characteristics already. So I mean, I guess the big thing is super rare is you have single artwork. So there's basically, you know, it's an artwork. There's only one of them.
Single edition.
It's kind of like the original idea of an NFT. Whereas the kind of Known Origin, you can do a single artwork there, or you can do like a series. So you can do 10 of the same thing. So obviously they're all unique in the sense that they're all their individual thing. But I guess there's less of a strong concept if you're buying, you know, if you're buying one of 10. Obviously in the real art world, where you have, you know, photographic prints or prints of paintings. Yeah, it's a way of getting access to artists you wouldn't otherwise be able to pay the prices for. It's kind of interesting. So, but it does seem, and I don't know if this is how much this for you was a reason for getting involved in art. But obviously for Ethereum, we've had in the last really few months, we've had this big DeFi boom. I think we'll discuss that a bit later as well. And that's driven a lot of value into the system. That's also spiked the gas prices. So now we're like 300 Gwei or something like that. So no blockchain game using Ethereum can now operate. They've all gone down basically to no users because, you know, it's games were what yep. we call kind of a high volume, low value kind of transaction. If you're doing something in a game, there's not a lot of financial value attached to that. Whereas DeFi, people are doing these activities because they're creating a lot of value. So obviously they're happy to pay gas prices of $10-$20 because they're putting $1,000, $2,000, $10,000 in. So we've seen kind of gaming, at least on Ethereum, kind of crater. and I guess to some degree that's meant we've been looking for something else to do, and kind of, you know, NFT artwork kind of fits into that gap. So has that been something as well that's kind of played into your interest in art?
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of money that's been made in DeFi. And I think to some extent that and a lot of money just coming into blockchain the first time, or maybe coming into Ethereum the first time, they're actually going into rare digital art. So let's talk about the different platforms and how they differ, because I think it's important to kind of tell the difference. So you were talking about Super Rare, and each of the artworks there is basically a one of one, and that makes it kind of like, I would say, the curated snooty art gallery of the blockchain, right? So artists have to apply, most get rejected, and it's only really the top flight artists that get there. So it's highly competitive to get in there, and even when you're in there, I guess there are maybe like 15 to 20 top buyers that would kind of really bid the price up, and the others would be going for lower price, maybe unless they get noticed by some of the whales. So like blockchain games, blockchain art is very, I would say, whale driven, but it seems like a lot of this activity right now is going into buying. So for example, you probably heard of Whale Shark. So he has a huge community around him, and he has his own social token. So he's bought, I think, over $500,000 worth of NFTs. And apart from Gods Unchained, the vast majority of those NFTs has really been artwork. And I haven't seen him sell a single piece of artwork. So that's a lot of money going into the system. And apart from Whale Shark, there are maybe five or six other, maybe top tier whales that can drop anywhere between maybe 5 to 30 ETH on artwork, put them in their vaults, display them in a museum in Decentraland, things like that. So this has really exploded just the ecosystem, because there are people who are willing to buy for good amounts. And as you go from Super Rare, there's Maker's Place, where I would say there are also artists that are doing editions of one, but multi edition is also encouraged. Most of my purchases come from Maker's Place, because I don't really have the deep pockets to compete with bids on Super Rare, so I've only bought two items on Super Rare, and there are a few other platforms, but there are two others that were worth talking about that I think are very interesting. So first one is Nifty Gateway. The last time we probably talked about Nifty Gateway, they were still like a payment gateway for credit cards, right? For blockchain games. And they were acquired by Gemini, by the Winklevoss twins. And now they've turned into basically weekly art drops. And the interesting thing about them is that they onboard a lot of new artists that are well-known outside of the crypto space. And a lot of them have their first NFTs in Nifty Gateway. This is highly curated. For most of the time that they've been doing the art drops, they've been only doing it once a week. And, you know, some are edition of one, some are multi-edition, but a lot of the artwork that drops on Nifty Gateway sell out like within the first couple of minutes, and then followed by a huge flurry of secondary market kind of jostling and trading. So it's very FOMO driven, and every week their servers are really slammed while, you know, people try to get the latest drops. And I've participated in a few myself. And the interesting thing about it is that I think Nifty Gateway is the closest we have to kind of onboard people from outside the crypto space to buy rare digital art. So I think that's really important. And if you can see it in their platform, that they've kind of abstracted away the blockchain as much as possible. And so there, you have a wallet, you can pay by credit card, and most of the time, your NFT stays on the wallet that's connected to their ecosystem. Only if you're an expert kind of blockchain user do you realize that you can take away the NFT from their platform and into your own Ethereum wallet.
I have to say, my biggest problem with Nifty Gateway is I really don't like the art. I just think the artwork is really, really kind of generic, sort of like exactly the kind of art you'd expect to people to be making NFTs around. At least I don't look at it every week, I have to say, but the first drops, I was just like, that's just super ugly. People are just buying that because they can flip it. So, but that's probably just my personal artistic oddities coming through.
Yeah, so yeah, I wasn't interested in the first couple of drops that were too crypto-oriented. But as they were onboarding more of just artists from outside the crypto space, I thought the art was getting more and more interesting. And I've bought a couple there myself.
Did you flip them straight away or did you keep them?
I've kept most. There was one piece of artwork that I bought on the secondary market like 10 minutes after the drop for like 100% gain. So it was like $250. I bought it for $500. And then a week later, I sold it for five times that amount.
So it's interesting. Because I guess one of the things is if you can keep all that money in your own marketplace, and then if people are making profits from that, then obviously that then drives the FOMO around the next drops. If that money then starts kind of flowing out to other marketplaces, then you potentially have a problem. So actually, they have quite a nice advantage in the sense that they're onboarding people who don't understand what they can do with this stuff. But then that's keeping liquidity in the market and driving those kind of more speculative things. If that's I guess that's important to businesses.
Yeah, that's very true. And for any of these marketplaces, you touch upon liquidity. The job of any platform is to actually have really good liquidity on their own platform. And because we're on blockchain, the liquidity can and will move elsewhere. And if you see all of these NFT platforms, whether like all of the art platforms, most of the game ones probably, they're all referencing OpenSea's database in some way. So for almost all of these, you can buy or sell the artworks that are in these closed marketplaces on OpenSea.
I think continuing down the artistic taste view. I think we both have art from the same artist. I'm gonna take a risky question here. So I think you have some art from Miss Al Simpson. Is that right?
Oh yeah. I probably have three or four pieces. I love the detail of her work and. Just the pinup poster quality and super high res, and these are just great pieces.
So I have to say, I only own two bits of artwork, and they're both from hers, both, and that's from Super Rare. So I was looking around just to kind of try to buy something, and I just generally find the art is not very good. And I wouldn't say her art is brilliant, but I would just say in comparison to all the other stuff out there, and also it's kind of at a price that, as you say, some of these prices are ridiculous. So it's kind of a price you can afford. So, and I kind of thought, yeah, I kind of quite like that kind of at least it has a, because a lot of the art could be quite computer based. And obviously there can be some very clever animations and things like that, which people can do. But I quite like the fact that it's digital art, but it has that kind of... she could be drawing some of it. I don't know if she's or not. But it has that kind of real world kind of collage, yeah, kind of things ripped out of magazines and scrapped around. So those are the two that I own.
I agree. I think I have four or five of her pieces.
and actually, moving on to the next thing. So I actually do also own some of the shards that she did. So on Niftex,
really?
Which I know you're quite into as well. So she was one of the early ones with one of it. Is it called a Bitcoin Bitch? Isn't it? It's one of her series ones she did. And there was one of those was one of those NFTs was sharded. So quickly explain that. What Niftex is you can take high end, expensive NFTs. And then you can basically break them down into smaller shards. And normally, typically, it's either 100 or 10,000 or something. And you break down a minority. So the person who owns the NFT still owns the majority, but then you can sell off kind of bits of it. And it's a way to these very high NFTs that it's very hard to sell on because they're very specific and there's not many people who can afford them. But you can allow people to buy, you know, very small percentages of them. And then that those traders, the ERC-20 tokens. So there's an interesting mechanic there. So how are you finding that? How involved have you been with NifteX?
Very involved. So actually, NifteX was kind of my introduction to the power of DeFi in the NFT space. So last year, I had bought Almis, which is one of the rarest Axies in the Axie Infinity universe. So Silituna and I bought the NFT for 27.5 Ether, which we thought was a good bargain. Like, we didn't know when we would be able to use it or sell it. But at that time, and for that Ether price, it was undervalued. Let's just say it was undervalued. And so we kind of just sat on it for over a year, just not knowing what the future plans were. And then 4chan kind of hit Axie Infinity really hard. So it was funny. So let me make a side story first. So 4chan Biz is very, I would say, notorious in the crypto scene because there are a lot of people there who kind of shill random coins, and then much of the community goes into it, and then the coin value goes up. And then eventually those people on Biz kind of dump on the rest of their community, and then it kind of dies away. And they've been doing that on random coins for a long while. So what happened was that Axie Infinity's SLP, the Small Love Potion, became the target of one of those pumps. And what happened was that the price of the Small Love Potion, which is the cryptocurrency, it's a currency that you earn when you win games, but it's also an ERC-20 that can be traded on Uniswap. It went up 20 times from basically less than 1 cent. I think it even hit 20 cents for a while. So it was insane. And what happened was that it made the gamers who were playing Axie every day rich for a short time being. So of course they sold their SLP, a breeding stop, because like, who wants to breed if you can just sell it in the market? And even as the price went down, it actually settled at a level that is much higher than it was prior to this pump. So now SLP is at around 2 cents, and Axie kind of gained like a different level of attention from the broader community. And so I was playing actually a lot of the arena PvP when that happened. So I kind of took a break from blockchain and blockchain games, maybe like second quarter of the year, as kind of as COVID kind of hit, had to reorient like how I would do things at home, at work. So I was kind of preoccupied with other things. But as things kind of settled down, I started picking up Axie Infinity again, and I was playing a lot of the arena when that happened. And so it just kind of hit me when this thing happened that this might be a good time to try NifteX. I wasn't the first person to shard an Axie or an NFT on NifteX, but I realized that what NFTs need is liquidity, and what will make NFT space explode is liquidity, and any kind of liquidity that you can bring into it is crucial to unlock the value of NFTs. So I talked to Jiho and asked him to introduce me to the NifteX guys, and they really liked the idea, so we went with it a few days later, and it worked. We listed Almes at 40 ETH valuation. It got sold out in 6 hours. And then when we put it on the open market, I think Biz picked it up again, and it reached like over 300 ETH. Yeah, and that's with over 1,000 ETH of volume. So it was really insane. And it really put then another level of a spotlight on Axie Infinity, because they had what was like a $40,000, $50,000 item at that time, right? So it's kind of leveled down. Like there was a bug that they had to fix that required the shards to not be traded for 2 weeks. So now we're kind of restarting from scratch. But it's really shown, just like, if you put liquidity in NFTs, like, magical things can happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And another project that I know you're interested in, and I'm certainly am interested in, is this Arva Gotchi, which is coming from the DeFi team at Arve. So Arve, you know, to some degree, a few months ago, maybe a bit longer than that, was a fairly kind of straightforward DeFi project where you locked in collateral, you took some DAI or some ETH or some USDC or something, locked it in as collateral, you got a small interest rate, a couple of percent interest rate on that. Obviously, if you then wanted to, you could take out a loan in another token. Obviously, that's a higher interest rate and you paid it back at, and the interest rate kind of flowed through to the people who put in the original collateral. And there's some cool things you could do with flash loans if you were a coder, but it seemed like a fairly sort of straightforward sort of dApp. And then we've had all this kind of yield farming and all this governance token stuff, and
not that different from Compound or Maker, right? Yeah, that's right.
So all this kind of bonkers stuff has gone on, and now Aave have launched this Aave Gotcha program, which apparently they've been working on for over a year, the white paper says at least. So and that's kind of like trying to take, you know, it's a game, but it's a Tamagotchi NFT, and it has these A tokens as collateral within the NFT. So not only do they have a kind of fixed value, a floor value. If you put $100 worth of tokens in, obviously the NFT is going to be worth $100, but because it's interest bearing, because you get this interest, the value is going to go up over time. And there's loads of other cool stuff they're doing. So do you think that this is something that's going to be significant for blockchain gaming, or is this just sort of like we've had this weird thing with DeFi and the DeFi people have now got a lot of value and they want to just kind of reach out and extend, and they're kind of messing around with games? Is it significant, or is it just a bit of a...
For me, it is super interesting. I like the idea of a collectible that is backed in value by basically money, right? Interest-bearing money. And it's from an intellectual level, it's definitely in the middle of the NFT and DeFi space that I'm interested in. They're also doing some cool things like the Aave Gotcha as wearables. So they're using the 998 composable standard, putting the wearables in. I'm not like super clear on, I guess, what kind of world the Aave Gotchas will be living in. But that's actually pretty cool, because I think it gives an opportunity for the different kind of virtual worlds and blockchain games to kind of put the Aave Gotchas in their universe. So yeah, it's a super interesting experiment. Each Aave Gotcha will have different traits, but the traits... like it's not necessarily better or worse. They have a range of different traits that will make your Aave Gotcha do different things. And I guess if you import your Aave Gotcha in a virtual world, then it can do different things. Like, for example, if a sandbox wanted to import Aave Gotchas, they would look kind of different, but they'd have the same traits. Axie could probably do the same. So just having the concept of, you know, I have a virtual character that may have its own environment. It has certain fixed traits, and it has you can kind of farm for increasing rarity. It's a concept that's actually very portable around a metaverse.
But this kind of idea of interoperability has obviously been around since we started talking about blockchain games. And apart from the early days of CryptoKitties, where we had the Kittyverse, which is some interesting concepts, nothing kind of took hold. We've never really seen anything. And it's like Engine with their whole kind of quite complicated system they've tried to create. You know, they've created it technically, but there hasn't been any user. So I don't know if interoperability is just beyond us at the moment, or whether it's something we should even be trying to do. I don't know.
Yeah. So a lot of people from the traditional game space have really found the concept of interoperability kind of stupid. They've actually pretty much dismissed it. But I've always believed in its power. But the thing with interoperability is that your kind of base layer of applications need to be working by themselves first, right? So like Axie has to be working by itself as a game before I can introduce things from outside it that may possibly be interesting. And if you look at their concept of interoperability, it's actually been bringing DeFi elements. They've had a partnership with Maker, for example, wherein if you open the Maker CDP or Vault, you get this rare item inside the Axie universe. They did the same thing with Kyber, which I thought were very smart partnerships on Axie side, because they actually brought people in who weren't kind of familiar with the gaming space. And for the people who were gamers, it was their first time interacting with actually like a DeFi service. So it was good both ways. And that's an example of a really good interoperability. And one really good, another example of interoperability that is outside the game space is what you're seeing now with yield farming. So now you're seeing some crazy things in yield farming where someone forks a protocol And then a new currency comes up, people mine it, and you have to stake different currencies in able to mine that new coin. And because the coin is new and people are buying it, you have kind of crazy yields. And, you know, the Ponzinomics, as they call it, it goes on until, I guess, people decide that, like, there's not much value. And sometimes it gains value on its own, but there have been a lot of clones that are just trying to capture money from themselves. But what's interesting is how they take the concept of composability and interoperability between different protocols. So, for example, YAM, which launched last week. So what happened was that you could stake different currencies. So it was Compound, it was Wi-Fi or Wi-Fi, it was Lend. So you could stake these different ones and earn basically YAM, right, as currency. And what happened was that, number one, the prices of these currencies shot way up because people were buying them and putting them into YAM. And second, and I was affected by this, the interest rates for these currencies inside lending product actually shot way up as well because people were using them to farm. So if you were careful, something that had maybe 5% interest that you were borrowing suddenly became 40% interest because a lot of people were borrowing it. So that's interoperability to me. But for YAM to have been a product of that interoperability, it was built on top of, you know, synthetics, Compound, even Wi-Fi, which is built on other things, and MakerDAO, all of these protocols that were already very strong ecosystems of themselves. And now that, you know, DeFi always talks about it as money Legos, right? You have different components that can interact with each other. That's basically what interoperability is.
But I think that's much easier to do in the token space than in the NFT space, isn't it? Because you can just take tokens and lock them in and create new tokens. Because it's a fungible token, then there's no issues with valuation. I mean, the issues with NFTs have always been about, you know, the developer creates some tokens, some NFTs. They say that they're worth this, which is obviously just a stick in the, you know, finger in the air sort of thing. And then the value is only driven by kind of a rough comparison between this NFT in this game at roughly this level sold for 0.1 ETH. So my one's going to sell for 0.11 or 0.09. There's no inherent value. So I guess the interesting thing about stuff like Avogadro's, and I think there's been a few other ones where they've tried to put gold-backed tokens in there. Axie did that one, and again, Engine have always had this idea. You have Engine Coin in, you know, kind of as part of a collateral, although it's not particularly
DeFi token.
But there's a lot of that kind of stuff, and I think that's really valuable because then that just provides a floor price of these sort of things.
A floor, at least a floor value.
Yeah. And I think games have, you know, we've proven to have the NFT stuff to be very speculative. when there's no information and no game, people sell NFTs because that's when you get the most FOMO sort of thing. So I do think from that point of view, I think DeFi coming into gaming is valuable because I think they do, as much as this DeFi yield farming has been a speculative bubble, they do understand, I think, kind of how tokens work and how they might be attached to some sort of real value in the sense of kind of future kind of revenue flows, even if it's just small amounts of interest, I guess. And I think game developers have really, you know, not had any experience in that. So I think DeFi can help in that. And I think more generally, what will be interesting, I think, is DeFi. These DeFi dApps have now raised like tons of money with these tokens they've just created. But once yield farming is kind of a retention mechanic. If you provide the best yield, then people will stick their tokens in your DApp. But the competition becomes ridiculous, and at some point you just want to go, how can I build a community? And actually, games, you know, have always been great at building communities.
Yeah, that's right.
So I guess for the DeFi DApps, you know, even though blockchain games on Ethereum haven't, like, you know, become massive, the fact you can build these kind of communities and they're sticky and they come back every day to do something that's not actually based around financial value, I think is quite valuable for DeFi companies. Whether we'll see more than just these Avogadro's, I don't know. As you say, Maker's been doing this for a while in gaming at a slightly different level. I don't know whether, you know, the kind of the compounds and the balances and the Uniswaps and all those kind of things quite how they could do that, but it would be interesting. And I do think taking composability as a general term, the composability of that kind of categories, so DeFi and gaming and other things as well, that's as valuable, I think, in the long term, but just is much harder to do. So I guess it's why it takes a lot longer to bring these things together.
I think the biggest gift of the DeFi space to gaming has actually been Uniswap, because if you think about the last 2 years, the only way that a lot of these game developers can get started and bootstrap themselves was doing an item sale, right? And it kind of became like an ICO, and it was unsustainable. And I think the worst part about it was that you were really inflating people's NFTs to the point where there was little value. So, of course, that was the original CryptoKitties model. A lot of people have evolved since then. But it was unhealthy for the game that I guess there were too many NFTs, more than what the game could bear. And with the rise of Uniswap now, the interesting thing is that any small community can bootstrap themselves by having a trading pair of their community token, governance token, whatever, with Ether. So, you know, like, it doesn't matter if you're a crypto artist, if you're a small game community, if you're a DAO, like, even a small community, like the Almaze one is a subgroup of Axie Infinity, right? As long as there was a community that kind of believed that this had value, then you could put value in it. And people put value in it because the moment you put your token in a Uniswap liquidity pool, you have to match it with ETH. So for example, I put in 100 Almaze tokens, and then I put in 100 ETH at the same time. That implies that my starting value is one Almaze, is one ETH, right? And then people will buy or sell the token, like, just according to what their belief of the market is. So that's been very, very powerful, and it's given power to small communities that can bootstrap themselves, start small, but as they kind of gain traction, their coin becomes more valuable. And, you know, Whale Shark has done this very brilliantly with his social token. You've seen crypto artists such as the Hakatao duo, they have their own Mork social token. You've seen social tokens that have gained maybe 100x in a matter of days before falling down. But social tokens and being able to make any currency for any community, big or small, has really allowed some communities to prosper without having to resort to a large NFT sale that would have diluted the NFTs of their players.
Mm-hmm, that's a good point. And I think with things like Balancer now, we don't have to back at a ratio of 1-to-1.
That's right.
That's potentially even more valuable in future where do these sort of things. So anyway, cool. I know we could talk for a lot longer, but I think we've kind of covered everything that I wanted to cover. So thank you so much for your time, Gabby.
No, thank you. It's great to talk about this, and yeah, willing love to chat about NFTs and DeFi all day.
You have to come back next time. Make it number 4 at some point when there's some crazy things going on. But thanks very much for coming on the show, and thanks very much, listeners, for listening to episode 75. We are available through all the usual podcast providers, and we are every week we're talking to the people who are making the world of blockchain games, which is always fascinating. Always going in different directions that I would never have imagined even a few months ago. So I hope that's interesting for you guys. If you want to find me and Gabby on Twitter, I'll put the Twitter in the link. What is your at, Gabby? You can do it.
Gabush, GABUSCH.
Okay, and I'm Blockchain GMG. But thanks for listening, and hope to see you next week.